I'm Marco Werman. One of the things I love about our show is all the music we feature from around the globe. We've heard from so many listeners that music on the world is something they look forward to. I know many of you become fans of the artists we introduce you to. I'm sure you're aware that we have a fundraiser going on right now. When you make a gift of $100 or pledge $10 a month, we'll send you a curated playlist highlighting some of our team's favorite tracks from the show. Whether you tune in for the music or the independent reporting on international issues, it's your support that keeps us going strong. Please give today to help power our nonprofit newsroom. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. Again, that's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Now, on to the show.
Palestinians in Gaza, caught in the middle of the war between Israel and Hamas, are running desperately short of basic needs.
I have never heard of a situation in which people are relying on 1 to 3 liters per day of drinking water.
Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers have recovered the body of another hostage that was taken by Hamas. I'm Carol Hills. Also today,
there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of control of movement that prevents people from telling the world what's been happening.
Advocates for minority Uyghurs and Kazakhs in China are still fighting for them to be freed. And the American Samoa soccer team goes from being the underdogs to the stars of the big screen.
American Samoa Warriors, show me how to fight. I'll show you how to win.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thank you for spending this Friday with us. Today, Israel's cabinet approved a plan to send 2 daily shipments of fuel into the Gaza Strip. Sanitation and water systems have been shut down because of the lack of fuel there, and there's a desperate need for water. We'll bring you that story later in today's show. But first, aid agencies say that deliveries of basic humanitarian goods have slowed down to a trickle. The United Nations is warning that starvation is an immediate possibility. Israeli soldiers in northern Gaza have been battling Hamas militants. They say they've been finding weapons in schools, homes, and hospitals. At Al-Shifa, the main hospital in Gaza City, the Israel Defense Forces says it has recovered weapons, ammunition, and at least one booby-trapped vehicle. For more on all of this, we go to the world's Matthew Bell, who's in Jerusalem. Matthew, Al-Shifa Hospital has been a focal point of the Israeli ground operation in Gaza. What's the latest there?
That's right. The IDF today said that its troops were still operating in and around the hospital. Last night, the military said that it recovered and identified the body of Noah Marciano. She was a kidnapped soldier. Her body was found near the hospital. She was among the large group of people, mostly civilians, who were taken hostage on October 7th by Hamas. Earlier yesterday, the IDF said it found another body of a hostage victim near Shifa Hospital. She was identified as 65-year-old Yehudit Weiss.
Has the military located the tunnel complex it says has been built under the hospital?
This is a huge question, Carol, and the IDF has said, and they've provided some video of a tunnel entrance that they said is near Shifa Hospital, but so far we really have not seen pictures or video or anything that really suggests like a major underground headquarters in the way that Israeli officials have talked about leading up to the ground invasion into Gaza. U.S. officials have also backed them up on that, said that they've seen the evidence, but again, it's just we'll just have to see what else the IDF presents in terms of evidence of anything like a Hamas headquarters that's underground.
What about the possibility of starvation in Gaza? That's something the UN is concerned about. Can you tell us more about what you know?
This is a warning that's coming from the United Nations and other aid groups, and they're pointing out that something like 1.5 million people at this point are now displaced in Gaza. There's a lot of people that from the north, they've heeded the Israeli military's warnings and gone south. Since the start of the bombing campaign, which has continued all this week, it's been very difficult for aid deliveries to get into Gaza, and apparently things are just getting worse there. The fact that phone and internet connectivity has been disrupted and fuel has been scarce, this has just become exceedingly difficult for people to get food on a daily basis there. Keep in mind, Carol, that before the war, something like 500 trucks of food and various goods were all going into the Gaza Strip every day from Israel. And that border crossing was closed when this war started. The total number of deliveries through the Egyptian crossing at Rafah, that's the other side of the Gaza Strip, is something like 1,000 trucks. And that's in the last 6 weeks.
Final question, Matthew. You're in Jerusalem now. You have frequently reported from the region over the years. Do you see any resolution ahead?
That is really, really hard to see right now. Things are very grim. Palestinians are just in agony when you talk to them about the rising death toll in Gaza. You talk to Israelis, they're deeply concerned about the fate of these hostages. The news from the West Bank is not good. There have been almost daily clashes between Israeli troops and Jewish settlers there with Palestinians. People are very worried about where that's going. Carol, just before you called me, within the last hour, there were rocket siren warnings going off across towns and cities in central Israel. In the north, there's been back and forth attacks between the Israeli military and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And here in Jerusalem, things just don't feel normal. There aren't many tourists around, for example. That's very noticeable. And finally, just in talking with people, Carol, Israelis and Palestinians, I keep hearing people say some version of this is just something they've never seen before. And people are really full of anxiety about what's ahead.
That's the world's Matthew Bell in Jerusalem. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Thanks, Carol.
The Prime Minister of Thailand has been in San Francisco this week. Seta Thawisen met with other world leaders at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, or APEC, which ends today. While there, Seta took time to pitch a mega project so grandiose that it could change the world. At least that's what he's claiming to potential investors. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports that not everyone believes he can pull it off.
The sun is just coming up here in Thailand, and I'm walking along an isthmus. It's a narrow strip of land that separates two giant bodies of water. In front of me is the Pacific Ocean, and behind me, past where I can see, is the Indian Ocean. And the only thing dividing them is this thin membrane of land. For more than three centuries, monarchs and empires have dreamed of cutting through it with a giant canal. It's only 30 miles across at its narrowest point. Siamese kings have proposed it, so did the British Empire and the French Empire. Now Thailand's government says it will finally do it, create a shortcut between the two oceans. Advocates say this could be a make-or-break moment for the country. This is a huge opportunity, says Sattapon Keo Witmon, an engineer who's advised the Thai government. Trillions of dollars in trade flow between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Oil, sneakers, iPads, everything. Right now, ships travel around Thailand, then up through the Straits of Malacca, one of the most crowded shipping channels in the world. But just imagine, Sattapon says, if ships could cut through Thailand, saving 4 to 6 days. He says the canal would be good for Thailand and the world. Cargo ships would use less fuel, lowering carbon emissions. Global trade would get more efficient. And Thailand would make money by charging tolls. That is the pitch. That's Thailand's Prime Minister, Seta Thawisen, unfurling a paper map on Thai TV, explaining he'd just sketched out this project for Chinese investors in Beijing. That was 3 weeks ago. The Thai leader is now trying to convince corporate America to chip in. Sattapon says the U.S. needs this project, too, to show the world it's not just obsessed with conflict. America should try speaking the language of economics, he says. Don't just speak the language of war. But if this canal is such an amazing idea, why has no one built it yet?
It's just a bad idea. It's a very bad idea.
Mark S. Kogan is a professor at Japan's Kansai Gaidai University. He says digging the canal through the jungle would destroy the environment and plunge Thailand into debt.
Thailand doesn't need any more debt, particularly for a project that isn't well thought out.
These are frequent criticisms, and Thailand's government has scaled down the canal concept, suggesting a land bridge instead. That means putting two giant ports on each side of the isthmus. and linking them with a superhighway. A ship would dock on one side, its cargo would zip over land, and a different ship would pick it up on the other side, taking it onward. This land bridge would cost about $35 billion, roughly half the cost of a canal. It's still a shortcut, Thai officials say, and still a game changer. Professor Kogan does not agree.
No, it is not a game changer. This is not like the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal can cut 8,000 miles off a ship's journey. The Thai Canal, or the Thai Land Bridge, would save about 800 miles. But cheerleaders for the shortcut insist it's worth it. It's a sure thing, says Satipon, the former government advisor. He says there's no better way forward than this. But so far, Prime Minister Seta, seeking investment in California, has yet to announce any takers. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen in Thailand.
There's political turmoil in Guatemala this week. Prosecutors there have filed legal challenges against President-elect Bernardo Arevalo. Arevalo shocked Guatemalans when he won the August presidential election. Since then, he's faced a number of legal challenges. Members of Arevalo's party have also been subject to raids and arrests. To find out what's going on, we're joined by Will Freeman. He's a fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We reached him in a taxi cab in Mexico City. Will, what exactly is the motive for prosecutors to file these legal challenges against Guatemala's president-elect?
To me, it's pretty clear. In Guatemala, prosecutors and judges collude to sell impunity to the highest bidder, to allow narco-traffickers, organized crime, corrupt politicians to operate with no consequences. Now, Arevalo ran on promises of changing that status quo. He captured a huge amount of popular support. He beat his competitor, who was aligned with the establishment, by more than 20 percentage points. So, you know, I think there's a lot of fear among these actors in Guatemala who profit so much from impunity that very soon things are going to change.
Arevalo is due to be inaugurated as president of Guatemala in January. First of all, is that normal that there's a four-month period between getting elected and taking office in Guatemala, or is it because of the pushback?
No, this is normal that there's a gap in a transition period. What's abnormal is all the legal challenges that you're seeing and even, the judicial persecution of the incoming president's party. That's not something Guatemala has seen in any recent electoral cycle.
How are prosecutors going about trying to take away Arevalo's political immunity? I mean, what are they basing that on?
They're trying to strip his immunity from prosecution for tweets. A few months ago, Arevalo tweeted that he thought a student protest movement in Guatemala's only public university was a sign of hope for the country. And apparently, prosecutors are taking that as the basis to try to strip him of his immunity and prosecute him for usurpation, sedition, and illegal association. I mean, these are legal figures, illegal association, for instance, that were created to prosecute narco-trafficking, a very serious issue in Guatemala. Now they're being turned on a politician who corrupt prosecutors and judges just simply don't like.
So are the charges against him that his tweets were somehow a crime?
We haven't seen all of it yet. I doubt that the prosecutor's office will stop there. Their strategy has been to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks in terms of legal charges. So they were involved in a months-long campaign to try to suspend legally Arevalo's party. They tried a number of different avenues to get to that outcome. So I think we're at a point where it's not really the legal arguments that matter. It's a sort of raw power and how far the prosecutors are willing to go in terms of defying the Constitution, defying popular will.
Arevalo says these moves against him are effectively an ongoing coup. Do you think that's a fair description?
I do. You know, I myself, I'm often skeptical when I hear presidents talk about soft coups or legal coups. So often, you know, that becomes a way to deflect a very real and merited investigations of malfeasance, corruption. In this case, it's maybe the one that I'd point out as where this rhetoric is very valid. Again, I mean, we're talking about a legal process for tweeting, right? A prosecution for tweeting or the suspension of Arevalo's party, supposedly for having collected a few signatures that didn't match up to the people who supposedly signed them. But obviously, it all comes from this attempt to stop a popularly elected president from coming into office and from ultimately beginning to dismantle this business of selling impunity that's so powerful in Guatemala.
What do you mean by selling impunity? What does that mean?
I mean that prosecutors and some judges collude with organized crime, narco-traffickers, corrupt politicians. They offer to get rid of investigations. They offer to give them lenient treatment or even clean their legal records, allow them to walk free when there's evidence found of crimes. That's been the pattern in Guatemala.
Bottom line, Will, do you think that Bernardo Arevalo will take office in January as expected?
I'm still hopeful, but I have to be honest, less hopeful than I was a few weeks ago. I saw these efforts by prosecutors for the longest time as simply an attempt to tie Arevalo's hands. Now I'm really worried that they are going for broke and that they will try to stop him, no matter what it takes, from assuming office.
Will Freeman is a fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been speaking to us from Mexico City. Thanks, Will.
Thank you.
You're with the world.
You ever been there when an uncomfortable question about race comes up, but you don't know how to answer? That's where Code Switch lives. Each week, we're talking about race and how it intersects with every other aspect of your life, from politics and pop culture to history and food. Listen now to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
Most people think they know all they need to know about Christian rock.
Whether you think it's cheesy propaganda pretending to be cool,
or if you think it's the only pop music unsullied by worldly vices,
you'll find something to love on Rock That Doesn't Roll.
I'm Leah Payne, author of A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
And I'm Andrew Gill, a public radio producer who grew up on Christian rock.
On Rock That Doesn't Roll, we're talking with people who loved Christian rock in its peak era and learning how it affected them as they grew up.
Listen to Rock That Doesn't Roll wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. This week, Chinese leader Xi Jinping visited the U.S. for the first time since 2017. He and President Biden had extensive talks on Wednesday. Both agreed to resume military communications at all levels. Xi also vowed to stem the flow of precursor chemicals, key ingredients in the production of fentanyl. What may have been lost, though, in all the headlines was discussion of China's human rights record, including the widespread imprisonment of the Uyghur minority in the far western region of the country. As the world's Duri Buscarin reports, a traumatized community fears it will be forgotten.
7 years ago, human rights lawyer Raihan Asat's younger brother returned to China after a trip to the United States and disappeared into the country's detention system. Asat realized she would face the same fate if she ever returned.
After seeing what happened to him, I never went back. In a way, he saved me from being in prison too.
In 2016, China began a widespread campaign to imprison Uyghurs and other members of Muslim minority groups in the Xinjiang region in what the government claimed was an effort to prevent terrorism. Asat's brother, 36-year-old Ekpar, remains in prison as Asat leads a global campaign to call for his release.
So much has been documented on this issue. So much has been exposed. And how come we're still in the same place?
Today, only Asat's parents are able to speak to her brother in prison in short, supervised phone calls. He's one of an estimated 1 to 3 million people detained during China's so-called Strike Hard campaign. Individual testimonies of these detention camps are incredibly rare, but those who have survived detail waterboarding, sexual abuse, and near starvation.
People are really, really, really scared.
Maya Wong, Deputy China Director for Human Rights Watch, says that even today, Uyghurs who served time in these camps are often forbidden from leaving China or contacting family abroad, and they're afraid that speaking up could get them sent back to prison.
There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of control of movement that prevents people from just telling the world what's been happening.
When I interviewed one woman about the time she was held in a so-called re-education camp in 2018, she was afraid that her husband and children, who still live in China, could be imprisoned if I identified her publicly. Because officials recorded her before she was booked into the camp, I can't even let you hear her voice. This is a colleague reading her quotes, translated into English.
We want to be heard. And we want the world to know these stories.
For now, I'll call her Aaliyah. In Xinjiang, most of Aaliyah's neighbors were members of the Uyghur minority. Many are Muslim and speak a language that's closer to Turkish than Chinese. But Aaliyah wasn't Uyghur. She's Kazakh, another Turkic minority. She worked a civilian job for the military, was a proud member of the Communist Party. Around 2016, she says, her office started advertising what they called health checkups.
These were full medical checkups, including your mental abilities, your ability to read, your ability to sing, your ability to perform, your organs. They did an X-ray. They analyzed the quality of your hair, your teeth, and your bones.
Many Uyghur names were hard for members of the Han majority to pronounce or spell correctly. so they called Aaliyah in to help with translations.
In the beginning, people would come voluntarily, like, oh, free medical checkups. But in time, as the camp started to open, they would bring people in handcuffs.
Aaliyah's description matches a practice that has been well documented by survivors and human rights groups. At first, biometric data helped government officials track Uyghur civilians moving around in Xinjiang. Later, it was used as a pre-booking process for re-education camps. Aaliyah started to see people she knew get sent to the camps, other Kazakhs.
I was devastated. I felt like they didn't deserve it, because there wasn't any particular harm the Kazakhs had done to the Chinese. This was the land they had lived on for a long time.
After a while, there was a decree that everyone working in the government had to name two people to go to the camps. Aaliyah says she wouldn't do it, but eventually she was named. She was arrested in the spring of 2018.
When we first arrived, we were in this very tiny room with 50 people in the same room. 50 people could only fit while standing, so we had to do three shifts of some people standing, the rest lying down, for 6 hours.
Satellite imagery, analyzed by Reuters, shows that the system of camps in Xinjiang tripled in size from early 2017 to the summer of 2018. The government released videos of detainees taking classes in Mandarin Chinese, reciting party propaganda, and participating in dance pageants. But Aaliyah's experience was much different. After being moved to a new location, Aaliyah was subjected to a form of torture that other survivors have also described.
We were forced to lie down on the floor, facing up. We had to look directly into a 500-watt lamp that was so bright it would burn our eyes. We weren't allowed to put our hands over our face or our mouth. We had to constantly look at it.
She says food was basic, and for the entire year, she never tasted salt.
It was just enough food to survive, so we wouldn't starve to death.
The children of people like Aaliyah, who'd been detained, were often taken to government-run orphanages and taught to speak Mandarin Chinese. At one point, Aaliyah says, the prisoners in her dormitory were shown a Communist Party video of a group of schoolchildren living in one of those orphanages.
It shows those kids standing up and reciting the Chinese short stories and songs. And one of the kids was apparently a great-grandchild of one of the oldest women in there.
That night, Aaliyah says, the great-grandmother took her own life.
And it was the first time the lights went off. The screens went off. And they rolled her body in the blanket she was sleeping in and dragged her away.
Aaliyah survived, but barely. When she was finally released from the camp in the fall of 2018, she had dropped more than a third of her body weight. Today, she's living in another country, but can't stop thinking about her fellow inmates.
I am a living witness to everything, and I am ready to share it if something happens to my children or my husband.
China says it closed the re-education camps in 2019 after an international outcry. But human rights experts say that's not true.
The party state has not closed the camps. It simply uses the camps as one institution in its mass arbitrary detention system.
David Tobin, a lecturer of East Asian Studies at the University of Sheffield, says the re-education camps simply became part of China's larger system of forced labor and prisons.
Whole families were being detained, but then being dispersed across the region, sent to prisons hundreds of miles away from each other, and almost no information about them is released.
Some prisoners have been released after serving time. Many are in extremely poor health. They're sent home to die in the presence of their families.
So there are still up to 1 million people in arbitrary detention who have not been given trial, but the region itself is now being presented as open for business.
China's government wants to move on from this story, Tobin says. But even as it falls from international headlines, Uyghur and Kazakh activists say they'll keep fighting for their loved ones to be freed. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin.
I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories
as we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise.
What is a mother, we ask?
And everything answers.
Mother is a question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The news can be disorienting, and it can be really hard to remember how we got here. That's why we started the Throughline podcast. Every week, we take you on a cinematic trip into the past to better understand the present. Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
The airline industry contributes a fair amount towards the warming of the planet.
Last year's emissions from deliveries was something on the order of 400 million tons of carbon dioxide. That's equivalent to a medium-sized rich economy.
Are they paying attention? And what steps are they taking to help fix the problem? That's still to come on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Gaza, Israel continues its military campaign on the ground. It is now expanding its offensive in the south, where many people had fled. The fighting has made life in Gaza extremely difficult. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on one of the biggest challenges, access to clean water.
In the skies of Gaza this week, besides the bombs, there was also this.
All people are running, trying to carry some water.
Thunderstorms and rain. Bisan Oda filmed the downpour. She's a 25-year-old filmmaker who has been documenting the war in Gaza in the past few weeks. Her video, which she posted online, shows people running to take shelter.
Without any shelter, without any roof, without any place, people displaced, sleeping in the streets, sleeping in the schools, sleeping.
While
in
many were worried about a roof over their heads, this guy was in a mini celebration. A boy who seems to be around 10 years old, soaking wet, holding a bucket, is collecting rainwater from a gutter. God has sent us water to drink, he says. He knows we're suffering, so he sent us water. It's fresh water, he says, a smile on his face. Access to clean water has been a challenge in Gaza for a long time. Israel controls the pipelines that carry water into Gaza. It reportedly shut off the supply shortly after the October 7th attack by Hamas militants. It has also limited fuel into the territory. That has led to the shutdown of the water desalination plants. The result is a population of 2 million people trapped in a war zone with very little access to clean water.
I have never heard of a situation in which people are relying on so little water.
Syed Imran Ali researches water, public health and humanitarian emergencies at York University in Canada. He says even in disasters, the minimum amount of water a person needs is about 4 gallons. In worst situations, it's about 2 gallons per person. That's for basic survival. People in Gaza have less than a gallon, he says.
What it means in practice is that people have been forced to turn to unsafe sources of water to find something to drink. So people are turning to contaminated groundwater sources that have high levels of salinity and nitrates that are primarily used for irrigation purposes.
That leads to all sorts of health problems, he says, including kidney disease and hypertension. When there's no water, there's no cleaning, and diseases spread. The World Health Organization reports that in Gaza, the level of diarrheal diseases are 16 times higher in young children than they were before the crisis.
And these diseases, these diarrheal diseases, are amongst the primary killers of small children in any mass displacement scenario.
With health centers either out of operation or barely working, anyone falling sick would have little chance of survival, says Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan. She's a humanitarian doctor who specializes in pediatric intensive care. She's worked in Gaza and is in touch with many of her colleagues there. She tells me about the water situation at one hospital, which has been under Israeli attacks in recent days. The Israeli forces say that the Al-Shifa hospital is being used by Hamas and that they have an underground command center there. Haj Hassan reads me a statement a colleague sent her from the hospital.
The hospital is completely surrounded. Food and water have run out. The occupation hit the main water line. The conditions are tragic, and those in the hospital are screaming from thirst.
The Israeli military posted on social media yesterday that it has delivered about 1,000 gallons of water to Al-Shifa Hospital. Haj Hassan says those who have left the hospital aren't doing much better.
I spoke with one of my colleagues as a surgeon who had evacuated Al-Shifa Hospital and gone south, and I asked how they bathe. And the response was, well, you know, I was able to bathe for the first time using two small bottles of water. I don't know if it was clean water.
Scott Paul with the NGO Oxfam has been in touch with people in Gaza too, and he describes one issue that often goes overlooked in disasters.
Women and girls who are managing menstruation have a difficulty doing that hygienically and with dignity. So people are overusing menstrual products.
Paul says that some bottled water and trucked water are getting in, but they are by far the most expensive way, he says, to get water into Gaza. This is also not a long-term solution, he says.
You can't measure the dignity of Palestinians in the number of trucks or the number of liters of fuel. The solutions are much simpler. The electricity needs to be turned back on. The water needs to be turned back on. The fuel needs to be brought in.
And ultimately, he says, the fighting needs to stop. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Our coverage of the war between Israel and Hamas includes perspectives from all sides. To read and hear more, go to our website at theworld.org. You can also listen to our program online or wherever you get your podcasts.
Air travel after the pandemic slump is roaring back. That's the sound of military jets zooming in precision flyovers in the United Arab Emirates this week during the biennial Dubai Air Show. That's the trade show where companies like Boeing and Airbus do brisk business. This year, airlines, mostly from the Middle East, put in orders for hundreds of new planes. But in less than 2 weeks, also in Dubai, another gathering will take a very different look at air travel, COP28. The United Nations Climate Change Conference, where delegates will tackle the tricky issue of sustainable aviation. Dan Rutherford studies that. He directs the International Council on Clean Transportation. He joins us from Mountain View, California. Dan, how were sales at the Dubai Air Show this year compared to previous years?
Well, so far, sales look to be pretty robust, especially for Boeing. They've sold about 300 aircraft so far at the show, which is much better than their rival Airbus, who has sold less than 100 aircraft. But one thing that's notable is that there are a lot of sales of wide-body aircraft, which means that there's a lot of optimism about the rebound of long-haul international flights.
And does the popularity of wide-body aircraft, does that also translate into lots of emissions?
It does. So in general terms, emissions from a flight will scale with the length of that flight and also the number of passengers on the plane. So a wide-body aircraft that can seat 300 people, for example, and flies 6,000 kilometers will have a lot more emissions than a smaller plane that seats maybe 150 and is flying just 1,000 kilometers.
Remind us how much air travel contributes to emissions.
So there are a couple of different ways to look at this. Overall, aviation is responsible for about 3% of anthropogenic climate change. Looking just at carbon dioxide, in 2019, aviation emitted about 900 million tons of CO2, which is about the same size as the German and the Dutch economy combined. Wow. But the last way to look at it is to look at the contribution of aviation to a frequent flyer's carbon footprint. I fly frequently for work. And for those of us who do, they can often find that aviation will contribute 20% or more of their personal carbon footprint.
Based on what you're seeing at the air show, do airlines appear to be anticipating changes in their industry because of climate policy, or are they just doing business as usual?
When you look at the climate issue for aviation, it really breaks down into two areas. The first is the aircraft that are being sold, and the second are the fuels that are being used to service them. This show is very much focused on the aircraft themselves. And if you look at the number of aircraft that are being sold and the types of aircraft that are being sold, it does very much look like business as usual, like the industry is not making any large changes to address the climate crisis.
Huh. Now, Emirates Airlines, for example, they ordered 90 passenger jets from Boeing this week at the air show. That's a deal worth tens of billions of dollars. When will all those planes go into service?
So something to know about commercial aircraft deliveries is that there's very large delay between when an aircraft is ordered and when it's delivered. Typically, a major manufacturer like Boeing or Airbus has like a 7 or 8 year backlog. And that's the time between when an aircraft is ordered and when it's provided to the airline. So typically, an aircraft that's ordered today is going to be delivered around the end of this decade.
So that means these planes that are just being ordered today,
they're going to be around for quite some time.
That's correct. In addition to the 7 or 8 years it takes to deliver the aircraft, they'll typically be used for about 25 years in service. So that means that the aircraft that are being ordered and delivered this decade will still be in service sometime after 2050.
And is there a way to kind of calculate what that represents in terms of emissions that will be produced over the lifetime of these planes?
There is. One of the more interesting developments in this space is that manufacturers are starting to provide their own estimates of emissions of their aircraft after they're delivered. Both Boeing and Airbus are now doing this in their sustainability reports. If you go into those, you'll see that both companies are estimating that last year's emissions from deliveries was something on the order of 400 million tons of carbon dioxide. That's equivalent to a medium-sized rich economy.
So we're talking a lot of emissions.
We are. One of the more sobering trends right now is that most of the aircraft being sold are actually being sold not to replace older aircraft, but to service new routes. And we definitely see that at the Dubai Air Show, right? A lot of these Gulf carriers are expanding rapidly. And so manufacturers like to talk about new planes because they're more fuel efficient and they emit less than the plane they replace. However, according to our analysis, of 4 planes being delivered today, about 3 of them are being used to service new routes, and only 1 is being used to replace an older aircraft.
Wow. Dan, your whole job is about focusing on clean transportation. In your own life, have you changed your flying habits?
I have. I started this work about 15 years ago. I had an intuition that flying really dominated my own carbon footprint. And it definitely does. I fly a lot for my work. I attend UN agencies related to both aircraft emissions and shipping emissions. So ballpark flying is actually about 3/4 of my own carbon footprint, taking into account all of my work trips. So I definitely do. I fly as little as possible. I do use some new online tools to identify flights that are less emitting. And definitely, I'm all about trying to help develop policy to identify new technologies to reduce emissions even more in the future.
Dan Rutherford is Program Director of the International Council on Clean Transportation. He was giving us an environmental context for understanding the expansion of the airline industry on display this week at the Dubai Air Show. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you for having me on.
Sports documentaries have been popping up everywhere in recent years.
Great teamwork in the slam.
When you are in the mountains, you find out who you really are.
The films usually follow the best athletes and track their journeys to the top, but a new movie takes a different approach by documenting what's been called the world's worst soccer team. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
At a FIFA Men's World Cup qualifying match in 2001, American Samoa knew they were the underdogs against Australia. The Aussies first scored in the 8th minute. But then they scored again, and again, and again. When the final whistle blew, the scoreboard read 31-0. It wasn't an anomaly for American Samoa, though. They went 20 years without winning a single game.
Every league we go to, we always get killed.
Forward Charles Ula talked about how that felt in the 2014 documentary about the team, called Next Goal Wins.
You know, it hurts, you know, when you work on something so much. And have it crumble to pieces. We're always the underdogs, and we always will be until we prove them wrong.
The good news is there was a lot of energy on the team to do just that. Athletes continued showing up to practice year after year, and the country's National Soccer Federation even brought in Thomas Rongen, a Dutch coach with Major League Soccer success in the U.S.
American Samoa Warriors, show me how to fight. I'll show you how to win. Show me that you want to make it happen. Come on.
The dynamics between the coach and the team are the centerpiece of the inspirational documentary. And now they're at the heart of a scripted film by the same name, Next Goal Wins. Academy Award winner Taika Waititi, who is Polynesian himself, directed the comedy. Waititi says he wanted to showcase the American Samoan people and tell the ultimate feel-good underdog story.
The qualifiers are only 4 weeks away, Mr. Rongen. All I want from our team is just one goal. One goal.
Soccer and the love of the game are key parts of the story. But longtime American Samoan defender Jaya Sailua says the film is also about far more than sports. She's a trans woman and Fafafine.
The literal translation of the word is in the manner of a woman. So in the manner of a woman basically means having assigned the male gender at birth and then living otherwise.
Sailua says the Fafafine identity is accepted, understood, and celebrated across Polynesian cultures. That's clear in both the documentary and the scripted film. Sailua's teammates and locals wholeheartedly embrace her character, played by the actor Kaimana, who is Fafafine herself. It's the foreign coach, Thomas Rongan, who didn't understand in real life and on screen.
Tell me more about this Fafafine thing.
What do you want to know?
At this point, Rongan's character, played by Michael Fassbender, asks Sailua an invasive question that is often used to deny trans identities. The coach also calls her by the wrong name in the film, and someone else says she is not a, quote, real woman. One critic called YTT's treatment of gender flippant. But Sailua herself gives kudos to the film's writers for including those moments on screen.
We can't always sprinkle fairy dust on our experiences when it comes to the big screen. These actually happen. They were cringe for me to watch. They were even more cringe for me to experience. And if those scenes can do anything, I think people will end up sympathizing with those real life experiences of trans people and queer folk. And they can step up for them and, you know, defend them.
Sailua has played on American Samoa's national team for nearly 20 years. She still plays for them today, though the team is no longer ranked by FIFA because they don't play enough games per year. Sailua says having the documentary turned into a major motion picture is the last thing anyone on the island could have expected.
Because, you know, we just don't get that kind of attention.
Next Goal Wins received a standing ovation at the Toronto International Film Festival this year, and it hits theaters across the U.S. today. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Now to Maine, where Somali Bantu refugees began arriving about 20 years ago, fleeing civil war. There's a farm in central Maine where more than 200 Somalis grow vegetables. This year, they began a special trade with some of the state's longest-standing residents. More from Maine Public Radio's Ari Snyder.
On a recent afternoon at Liberation Farms in the town of Wales, Muhyiddin Liba scoops up a handful of dried African flint corn from a huge plastic sack in the back of a cargo van. A cascade of milky white kernels, tinged with yellow, orange, and purple, spills from his cupped hands.
Yep, that's what we have.
Liba is the executive director of the Somali Bantu Community Association, which runs the farm. He says flint corn is a prized food. But Liba says he's looking forward to giving away this corn, all 2,000 pounds of it, in a first-of-its-kind exchange with the Mi'kmaq Nation.
So the corn has been loaded on here, so I will be driving tomorrow. That's so exciting.
He'll drive back with 400 pounds of frozen brook trout from the tribe. Liba says he met representatives of the Mi'kmaq Nation through a grant program with the Maine Health Access Foundation and saw a chance to collaborate.
We love fish. And we don't have a lot of fish. They said, oh, we have farmers who are farming fish. And the idea came that, okay, why don't you give us fish and we give you corn?
And Candy Sock, Community Support Services Director for the Mi'kmaq Nation, says she sees other parallels as well.
Our histories are so similar.
The Bantu are an ethnic minority in Somalia with a strong agricultural tradition.
Displacement and the violence and the historical trauma are all there for both the Somali Bantu people and the Mi'kmaq Nation.
Sok runs the tribe's food pantry, which will distribute the corn, reconnecting the Mi'kmaq people, she says, with a historically important crop.
So we as a people need to be able to go back to our indigenous foods, our culturally identifiable foods.
Shannon Hill is the environmental director for the Mi'kmaq Nation. She's standing between two massive fish pools at the tribe's land-based aquaculture facility in Caribou.
Over on this side, these are our baby, our fries are small. They're only about 3 inches maybe, if that. And there's about 40,000 in that tank of those.
Hill says the food exchange could open the door to more cooperation.
And so we're really looking forward to going down there to see how they are growing certain things and what they're possibly doing different that we can bring back and incorporate into what we're doing here.
Today, the Somali Bantu farm is coming to her. Workers with the tribe move the corn to a storage shed and load fish coolers in its place. Meanwhile, Hill sits down with Liba as Candy Sock hands him a vacuum-sealed package of frozen trout.
And this is the trout that you're taking.
Wow. Yeah, so that's what it looks like. It's a beautiful fish, yeah. What trout are.
It's a nice pink
meat. Those are males.
Liba says the plan is to dry the fish at the farm and distribute it to community members. Candy Sock says she hopes that next year the Somali Bantu community will be able to participate in the tribe's Mawiomi, an annual gathering and celebration.
So the idea is for the Mi'kmaq people, who have been here for 10,000 years, to welcome officially the Somali Bantu people, the new culture to our area, the new people, and to exchange those cultures in a more meaningful way.
In the meantime, Sock says she plans to try some of the flint corn. She says she's never had it before. For The World, I'm Ari Snyder in Presque Isle, Maine.
This week, a plane that left JFK was forced to turn back over the Atlantic for reasons you probably wouldn't see coming. Here's the pilot talking to air traffic control.
Atlanta 4592, guys.
Yes, sir. We are a cargo plane. We have live animal horse on board the airplane, and the horse managed to escape his stall. We don't have a problem as of flying-wise, but we need to return back to New York. We cannot get the horse back secure.
In case you couldn't make that out, a horse got loose from its stall on a cargo plane. It might sound random, but there's a whole world of international horse shipping out there. To go inside this world, we called up Bastian Schroeder from the air shipping company for horses Equijet. That's equa, like equine. He's in Amsterdam right now. Okay, Bastian, when someone ships a horse, tell me what I'd see if I followed the horse from beginning to end.
Client buys the horse. Horse passes pre-purchase vetting, then we start taking over from there with the export blood analysis to picking the horse up from the stable of origin, to issuing the health certificates, booking the plane ticket for the horse to come to the United States, make sure it goes through all the mandatory quarantine, and then transport to its final destination.
For commercial planes, ones that are not designed for horses, could I be on a passenger jet and there might be a horse in the hold of the plane below me and I don't know it?
That was the case until 2020. KLM was the last airline which operated a plane called the 747 Combi. And we indeed, in that case, had 250 passengers on board. And the rear third of the airplane of the main deck position was designed to be cargo. And we had horses, or it could be a mixture of horses and other general cargo.
So what sort of accommodation does the horse have on your plane?
So we have three different service classes, just like on a regular plane, from economy class to business and first class. If you picture a regular plane, we have up to three horses across in a transport container. That's we consider economy. Then we have business class. That's two horses sharing one transport container or one horse by itself, which is called first class.
So in the cargo plane and in your plane, in your special service, are there flight attendants that take care of the horses?
We do. We typically have a flight attendant per stall, sometimes one flight attendant per two stalls, which could be up to six horses.
So how often do horses get loose when they're in a plane?
Hardly ever. That is a freak accident. And in this case, it was a very young horse that just got upset and just jumped out. And unfortunately, the worst case scenario that could happen.
So do you imagine that the pilot could look back and see that horse?
Grooms or attendants, they see the horse, then one of them has to go back up to upper deck and report back to the captain and say, listen, we have a problem.
Now, Bastian, your whole business is just to ship horses. How busy are you? I mean, are you shipping horses every day?
We do ship horses every day to all parts of the world.
Bastian, you're in Amsterdam right now. When's your next flight with a horse?
Tomorrow morning at 3 a.m.
Where are you headed?
We are heading to Miami.
How many horses?
We have a shipment of approximately 18 horses tomorrow morning.
That's not in one jet, is it?
That is in one 747.
Oh my gosh.
It can take up to 96 horses if we charter the entire plane.
Wow. Is that all economy or some business in first class?
That would be majority economy with a couple of passengers getting upgraded.
Incredible job. Incredible story. Bastian Schroeder is the founder of Equijet, which ships horses via air. Bastian, thank you for demystifying the world of horse shipping.
Thank you for having me.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here on Monday.
Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now the World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much and be well.